thanks to Autonomy Labs for hosting us tonight. If you guys are not on the mailing list, you should join. It's go to dorkbot.org and then pick San Francisco. And anyway, I guess we should just start. So our first speaker is Jill Miller, and she's going to talk about Bigfoot.
Ongoing art project, Waiting for Bigfoot, which is actually, there's a live camera in the campsite that's being cycled through right there. Some of you probably know Baba Lee from the SRL crowd, and she's tending the campsite while I'm away, so you'll see Baba Lee, maybe naked. I posted a little nudity, but I can't guarantee anything. Okay, so... Can you hear me if I hold it low? I'm like pulling up my... Okay, so I just want to really quick give credit where credit is totally due. I am the artist that's doing Waiting for Bigfoot. It was my idea, but I could not have done it without the help of a few people who are here, and Baba Lee's at the campsite right now. Chris Myers really researched all the solar technology and, where is he? He's hiding.
Over here.
Where are you? Oh, he's over there. He's going to answer technical questions.
There's Baba Lou.
Oh.
Mister. There's an issue.
Eric Paulus, right here.
Over here.
Did all the programming. And Seth Horcher and Baba Lou were the campsite attendants. So when I couldn't be there to wait for Bigfoot, they waited. And I'll just give you a little bit of background about me. I'm from Crete, Illinois. There's not a Greek in that town, but it's, you know, in the middle of... I married one. Okay. It's a little farm town. I got my bachelor's degree at Berkeley in literature. I just got my MFA at UCLA last year. And I'm visiting faculty at the San Francisco Art Institute now. And I just moved my thing, but that was my dog, Cleo. So I'm going to go over just two projects I did, just to give you a little bit of an idea of the kind of work I do before I get into Bigfoot. So there's a lot of work to pick from, but I'm just going to do two because I don't want to spend too much time on it. So I did a project for 2 years called the Cupcake Project. It was a from 1999 to 2001, was a web-based performance, and it mostly took place in the internet fetish clubs. Does anyone here work for Yahoo? We are down in Silicon Valley. Yeah, this is back when Yahoo didn't censor people. So, and actually, where's Dale McDonald? Yes, he's back there. Dale and I kind of, this project started because Dale and I used to instant message each other all the time. And one day, Dale was like, hey, have you seen this weird tampon club on Yahoo Clubs? And I was like, no, so yeah, I joined. I mean, you could type in anything in the club search engine, like hot dog, kitten, weird sex fun, and you'd find something. I mean, people could put any kind of club online if they wanted to. So the tampon club is probably self-explanatory. It was guys that like to suck on tampons after they were used, but there were other ones. I didn't really dabble in that. I really liked the inflatable fetish clubs. So anyway, the project basically was, I went into these clubs, became part of the community. I posed as Your Girl Cupcake. That's still my Yahoo IM handle. And I basically created this this character who lived on the web, and I traded photos of Cupcake having adventures with her girlfriends in exchange for instant message conversations, club member photos, and basically the friendship of people in a variety of fetish clubs. And the project's goal was to become a part of the community and learn about the secret lives that people lead on the web with our anonymous identities, and also what kind of implications anonymity brings, in addition to freedom, the kind of responsibilities that we have. Because obviously, you know, I was dressed up like a 16-year-old girl online talking to people that are much older than me, even though I was legal. So just a little bit about Cupcake. She was like the trusty schoolgirl next door, non-judgmental to a variety of kinks and fetishes. And Cupcake, after joining several Yahoo clubs, a person online started Cupcake's World, which was a Yahoo club where people of all backgrounds and kinks could come together and just be friends. And this was a novel thing, you know, that was like one of the first spaces where you could be anonymous and meet people based on your interests. And no one had to know. Just a couple things that Cupcake explored. The inflatable fetish, here's a photo of me and two other girls deflating a giant beach ball. So the inflatable clubs dealt with pool toys, balloons, beach balls, and then there was a variety of kinks within that. So some people were into inflating, some deflating, some popping. So, well, Cupcake did it all. With clothes on, I should say. There was never any nudity. It was all about kind of, as a British guy put it, taking the piss out of all that stuff on the web. So, we also did a little bit of wet mess. That's a little more mainstream. Everyone knows how wet, messy cakes, creams, you smear them, you lick them, do whatever. This is a little bit one, maybe less known, the sleeping fetish. Unconscious women, which at first kind of offended me, but after exploring a lot of the websites and actually looking at some videos, there was never any sex. It was like a woman would, it was very like a Victorian, like, oh my goodness, look what I saw, and then fainting, and then a guy would like carry a woman to the next room and settle down. And then she'd wake up and see something and faint again. So I was like, exciting, you know, it was just the series of fainting. And then there was also within that, like, the caring fetish, there was the acronym OTS, is over the shoulder. Maybe some of you know that. And then the cradle carry, which is another variant. And then one last one I thought I'd throw out there because it's one of my favorites, is the furry fetish. This is when Cupcake and Missy found a stray dog. Who they really believed to be a dog. Until they took off his head, and he was their professor, Mr. Peepers. And then, you know, this is of course my feminist agenda creeping in, they beat the shit out of him. They mummified him with toilet paper and spit on him. So anyway, there's tons of fetishes there. Yeah, you go on. Talk to me later if you have questions. So, one more project I'm going to show before we get into Bigfoot, which is totally different than the Cupcake thing, but still certainly deals with humor. It's a video I did called I'm Making R2. It's just 3 minutes. I'm going to show it to you, but it's an homage to John Baldessari, who was my professor at UCLA. And he did this, he was a pioneer in video art in the beginning. He worked with video, you know, in 1971 and on, maybe even earlier. But this is back when artists who did video art, it wasn't like the Bill Viola fancy installation. You know, it was get a camera, black and white, of course, aim it, and do a performance in front of it. And then, you know, of course, copy your boring performance 100 times and send it to everyone you know. And so you made a tape, and you sent out a tape. And I Am Making Art is a 22-minute durational performance where, you know, John Baldessari, basically every time he moves a muscle group, says, I'm making art. And it's like Tai Chi meets, I don't know, like abuse. You know, it's like, I'm making art, I'm making art, I'm making art, I'm making art. For 22 minutes. And he's really embarrassed by it now. So one day I was like, hey, you know, any chance I could borrow that tape and fix it up for you? You know, he's like, all right, here. So this is what I did with it. So.
I am making art.
This
work it, let me work it. I put my thing down, flip it and reverse it. It's your permission if I can't handle it. It's your permission if I can't handle it. If you got a big one, let me search it. To find out how hard I gotta work it. It's your permission if I can't handle it. It's your permission if I can't handle it. I like to get to know ya so I can show ya. Put the pussy on ya like I told ya. Give me all your numbers so I can phone ya. Your girl act the same thing, call me your mom.
Nations people in Canada and Native Americans here in oral histories with those groups. But the first documented sighting that we have in the U.S. was in 1830. And after that, there was always rumors of sightings. But then what really put Bigfoot on the map, I guess, was in 1959 when True Magazine did a story on the footprints that were found by Bluff Creek, in Bluff Creek, California. On Bluff Creek, next to Willow Creek. And there had been rumors of Bigfoot in that area. It wasn't called Bigfoot then. But then, in 1967, the famous Patterson-Gimlin film was shot. And that's kind of what Bigfoot, David's going to kill me for saying believers, but Bigfoot believers say is evidence that Bigfoot is real. I'm sure you probably know what the Patterson-Gimlin film is. That was a frame I showed in the beginning. So I thought, I saw an exhibition in Canada at the Natural History Museum about Bigfoot, which is, you know, it wasn't an art thing, it was the history museum, which made it real. But it was, you know, all these casts of footprints and film footage and handwritten reports that people had taken in the field after there was a sighting when they'd interview the witness. And, you know, so I was kind of blown away by this. This was last year that I saw the exhibit. And I was thinking a lot about Bigfoot, and I never really thought about Bigfoot except as this pop culture icon, you know, and I thought it was like this thing in the 50s and 60s that, oh yeah, people had saw the sighting, and then there was a guy in a fursuit later who admitted, you know, but I didn't think it was a phenomena that was still alive today. And so I started doing research, and, you know, what I learned was that there are hundreds of sightings every year in this country alone. And this image here is a map of the counties of Northern California, and they're color-coded by Bigfoot activity. So two of the main hotspots are El Dorado County, which is just near Lake Tahoe, and then Del Norte, which is up by the Oregon border. Of course, Humboldt looks great, but that's because they haven't finished, you know, compiling the data, but there are a lot of Bigfoot sightings in Humboldt County. And so, so actually, David Peskovitz, who's sitting here, who's a Bigfoot enthusiast, introduced me to Lauren Coleman, who's one of the foremost cryptozoologists. And if you're not familiar with that term means people who study undiscovered animals. So Lauren really turned me on to a lot of books and websites that dealt with Bigfoot. And just a little bit of background about what's going on today. Cryptozoologists believe that there are between 2,000 and 6,000 Bigfoot creatures in North America. There's been a sighting in every state in our nation except Hawaii. Who knows, maybe someday. Most of the sightings are in California, Oregon, and Washington. But Texas claims 100 sightings a year. And then the most recent sighting that I could find, I mean, you know, sometimes it takes a while for these things to get documented, but the most recent one I found was July 7th of this year, and that was a sighting in Oklahoma. Someone was driving home from work and saw a creature on the side of the road that was bending over, foraging for food, and the creature kind of froze like a deer in headlights, except that the view was from behind. So it was like, you know, they saw the Bigfoot from the back, and at first the person wasn't sure if it was what they were seeing. What'd you say? Goats. Okay. But when they talked to BFRO, the Bigfoot Field Researcher Organization who investigates these things, you know, they described their experience and the smell that they smelled. BFRO said, no, this is a Class A sighting. You saw something, and we're going to put this down. So that was... Okay. So what's going on? So there are hundreds of sightings every year. And this is like what I was thinking back then. There are hundreds of sightings every year. This phenomena is not dead. It wasn't this thing from the 60s with a suit. I mean, this is... People see this creature all the time, and it's not just people who go out hunting for Bigfoot. It's like people who are hikers who, you know, have no experience with Bigfoot. So it's not just the same group. So I came to the conclusion that there are a couple possibilities. This is my hypothesis of what was going on. The first one, there are undocumented apes living in forests in North America. That's exciting, right? The second one was that if A is incorrect, there are hundreds of people each year hallucinating that they see apes in the forest, which I find just as exciting. And then the third one is people who don't know each other from all over our country collectively lie about seeing a creature who doesn't exist, but these people don't talk to each other, but they give the same reports. That's also exciting. So this is what I was thinking. Any way you look at it, this is fascinating. And the Bigfoot community, so I got to know Lauren Coleman, as I mentioned, and I did some research, and I found the community to be really divided, and it was really surprising to me. I thought, honestly, I was going to find a bunch of nuts who were into this crazy ape in the woods, but I didn't find that. I mean, there are some nuts out there, but it's, in my opinion, the community is totally divided. I thought there was like a unified group of crazy people that encouraged each other, but there are people who believe in Bigfoot in a faith way. Like, it's real, I have ESP, I talk to it, you know, I saw it get off a ship when the UFO landed. Like, there are people that just believe in this whole paranormal phenomena. But there are a large group of people who actually approach it from a really scientific perspective. Hey, can you guys be quiet back there? I'm trying to talk. And they don't want to just believe in something blindly, but they say, we think it's possible there's an ape in the forest, and we just want to go see if we can get evidence. And it's fairly logical. I wouldn't say it's scientific, but it's not just nuts in the woods. The other sort of Bigfoot experience that people often have is Bigfoot as pop culture. You know, pop culture is infectious, ubiquitous, and totally inescapable. This is the world that we live in. This is American culture. And I think what happens with Bigfoot, being that it has such a rich history, and there's so many different groups that deal with Bigfoot, and there's so much going on that I think it gets... the idea of Bigfoot gets compressed and totally centralized and then ultimately commodified. Is Bob Alou doing something?
Yes.
Help.
No.
Oh, she's gone. Okay, great. I love it.
Help.
You better call the Forest Service. That's awesome.
She's playing with the fire.
Yeah, she is.
She was pretty convinced that she could attract Bigfoot. And I believe her. Bigfoot has become a monster truck, and actually I found this in Oregon. There's a scratch-off, you know, those lottery games you play with Bigfoot holding money. That's one of those scratchers. So this is the Bigfoot that most of us are familiar with in the world, which is, you know, it's kind of lame, I think, that, you know, it's a commodity. So after looking at all this stuff, I kind of had this idea, several ideas about what Bigfoot, I think Bigfoot means, and I'm not denying that Bigfoot exists. I don't really take a position on it. I'm trying to be scientific about it. But in my mind, what was interesting to me is that I do think Bigfoot is a symbol for ecological awareness and preservation of our national forests. Because if you think about it, and this is even by people who are kind of unlikely, environmentalists, like the Texas Bigfoot Republicans, they want to preserve the areas where Bigfoot might live. So I love Bigfoot as a symbol of ecological preservation. And then another thing that I think Bigfoot represents is the other path that we didn't take. You know, as humans, we move in, we build cities, we build suburbs, we basically totally change our landscape to be what we need it to be. And Bigfoot definitely doesn't leave a trace. We've never even found any Bigfoot poop. So he buries it, you know, we've never found a body. So, you know, so Bigfoot lives harmoniously with other creatures. And I love that. And then another thing I think Bigfoot represents is it's like, I think of sometimes Bigfoot as a secular faith. You know, in this time of desperation, and we live in a culture of fear where we have a war that isn't ending. And I'm speaking about Americans because this is where the phenomenon is. We have terrorism. There have been so many Bigfoot sightings in the last couple of years. You might have heard of the one recently in Canada where there was a hair sample that was taken. It was tested at the University of Alberta. It ended up being a bison. But... which doesn't mean Bigfoot doesn't exist, but I do think that, you know, for people that don't want to follow the Christian model, this is kind of a way to believe in something in a time where there's so much loss. And then, I guess, lastly, Bigfoot is also our desire to have mystery in the world, you know, where our science is trying to go out as far as we can into outer space and also inside as far as we can in our inner spaces, and there is, we're trying to know everything, how to stop the aging process, how to, what kind of, you know, compounds are on the surface of Mars. So in a way, Bigfoot's like the mystery, the thing that we don't know about, and I find that really exciting as well. So why wait for Bigfoot in the forest, except that we have Babalu fabulous things for us. But there was a call for proposals by, there's a show every year in England for young emerging artists all over the world. And every year there's a guest curator, and this year, Gustav Metzger, I don't know if any of you know who he is, he's a famous Fluxus artist who wrote the essay about autodestructive art in the 60s. And he called for proposals for this show, and he said you must propose art without the object, which I thought was just so great because it took the commodity away from art, which the art world is about buying and selling. And it brought art back to the experience that, that the artist has making and that the viewer has, you know, seeing the work. So that was exciting for me. And it also was an opportunity to make an artwork that both considered art history, like the land artist, performance art, while simultaneously adopting Bigfoot Hunter's methodology, just to be respectful to the community. So I did follow all the advice I was given. I'll get to that in a second. And then also, it was an opportunity to be part of a community that typically doesn't discuss the philosophical aspect of Bigfoot, which is the Bigfoot community. You know, they, I think they've been, you know, embarrassed and sort of dismissed so much that people in that community are typically not willing to talk about Bigfoot, you know, as a philosophical creature that we could use as a model for ecology or whatever. So I thought it would be exciting for me as an outsider to be able to do that while participating in their community. So then logistics. The performance took place, started July 2nd, and it goes till August 20th, this weekend. So someone's been living out in the forest, usually me, but other people have lived out there waiting for Bigfoot as well. The campsite. The campsite is essentially made up of, there's three infrared-enabled cameras that are on 24 hours a day. There's a video sequencer that switches between cameras. We have satellite internet. I mean, we're not at a campsite. We're not at a campground. We don't, you know, we take a shovel and we have to go to the bathroom, and you know, we're out there in the middle of nowhere. We go in the river and we need to take a bath. So, just like Bigfoot. And when Bigfoot needs to get online, he uses his satellite internet like I do. So I have, you know, my internet, my power book, we have all these things, and everything's powered by solar energy, which to me is really important because it felt like it, you know, it was with the vibe that I, my feelings about Bigfoot. So here's some photos here. This is me cooking breakfast, my dog begging. But I didn't, I put this here to show you that this is the screened enclosure, and underneath the red and white checkered tablecloth is actually where we keep our three Optima batteries and the video sequencer and the inverter for the solar power. And we hide it with that checkered camping-like tablecloth so people think it's a table. And then you see on the left there are two tents back there, and then there's another, a third tent here, and I'll go through each tent. This is the supply tent where we keep, you know, extra batteries, extra fuel, canned goods, you name it. These are our guest quarters. If anyone's free this weekend to go to the Bigfoot campsite, you're welcome to stay in my guest tent. There's a dog door on the left if you have a dog. Sit with your dog. And then here's the master bedroom here where the campground host stays. And if you look off to the right, about 100 feet down is where one of our, the creek camera is. Let me see where we're at now. We're on the campsite camera, but you'll see that we cycle to a creek. There's a river and a creek. The creek is the more, it's a closer shot. Here is the creek camera. You can see the infrared lights there that aren't on because it wasn't dark enough at the time we took the photo.
This is the shot. There's a spider web in front of
that. Oh, wow. See, I love when stuff like that happens. Wow. Okay, I gotta email Babalu about that. We do have to do a lot of maintenance on these things, usually. It involves spiders. bugs, you know, of any kind. We're being invaded now by these, like, moth worm things. But, okay. And then this is the campsite camera. We strapped it on your tree. And this is the river camera. Which I didn't bring a sequence, but there was a time where some hiker saw the camera and they got really scared. And I would probably steal it if I saw it. Because there's 100 feet of cabling, so I'd be like, where the fuck is this going? So they didn't, though. They were really polite. The hikers are so polite usually. So they just aimed it up and put a rock to prop it up. So for a while I was like, why am I seeing the sky? And then I found out that they'd done that. And then they told Seth, who was watching the campsite, we had to move your camera. We felt like our privacy was invaded. Okay, that's cool. I understand. It was, but okay. this is the satellite dish, and two of our four solar panels. We have 100 watt on the left and the 75 watt. And so that's like the logistics of the camp. So we haven't just been there hanging out doing nothing. You know, I was dedicated to participating in the Bigfoot community, so I asked people to give me advice for attracting Bigfoot. And, what was that? Waxing? Oh. Maple-flavored bacon. So I was told to fry up some maple-flavored bacon at your campsite, and Bigfoot will be attracted to the scent and will show up. Which we did, but he didn't show up, at least that I know of. But I thought that was interesting because maple-flavored bacon is not like a regular food that Bigfoot would eat, should Bigfoot be real. So it seemed a little strange. The other thing was tree knocking and triangles, which I'm going to read the email to you. This is from Ronster. Oops. I don't know how to go back. So, you know, Ronster wrote me, and he's like, basically, hi, I'm Ronster, I see your way through the grave, I've done extensive work with these creatures. So I wrote back, okay, what's your advice? So he says, well, first off, don't listen to anyone from BFRO, they're not good people. See, this is that divide between the believers and the science people. BFRO, they're like the hunters. What works best here in Ohio is you need to take a good hardwood stick, not one that has been rotting. So you take the stick and whack a tree. Live trees work the best, and the same kind of tree as the stick works best. Knock three times. I love that. Knock three times. Okay. Knock three times and wait. Sometimes it takes up to an hour to get a response. But just wait, and while you're waiting, think of triangles. Why? Why? I don't know, but it works. I love this. That was my favorite email I ever got. Also, think good thoughts, like, I want to believe, show me you're real. They'll know if there's a camera around, they'll avoid it like the plague. So you may want to do this a little ways away from your camera. Also, if you can bring some food and leave it for them, like an apple pie or chicken or watermelon, don't put it by the camera or they'll leave it to rot. I've tried the placing the food in front of the camera trick, and they don't buy it. They'll take it when I move the camera, so they would know it was there. Be honest, sweet, and don't litter. Show them that you care, and they'll probably treat you to a sighting. I just ask that if you do see something, you mention me as the source of your tip. So that was from Ronster. And then the other thing was this woman suggested that I get some crayons and some large paper and I sit out in an open area where Bigfoot could see me should he or she be spying from a tree. And I have to be really friendly to animals and smile and be pleasant. And draw pictures of me being nice to animals and being nice to Bigfoot. And then leave the pictures out overnight with crayons and blank paper and see if I get a response back. I know, at first I thought this is nuts, but then I realized that when people don't speak the same language, we resort to using symbols and drawing. And you know, the probes that we send out into outer space to aliens or, you know, other life forms always have these, like, glyphs written on them that show human, you know, male, female, you know. And so our first communications are often pictorial. So I thought that was brilliant, actually. So in closing, I don't want to talk too long because more people that are coming up. But in closing, there have been no sightings yet. We did set some apple bait, as we were instructed to do, and it was taken. It was missing 2 days after it was set out. One of the baits was in front of a camera, but as you can see, these photos are constantly being updated, and I have over 75,000 photos that have been taken. And so I have not gone through to evaluate the photos. So it's possible that they'll, I mean, if not Bigfoot, a bear. Like, I just don't know. Or a serial killer. So speaking of serial killers, I heard branches breaking and rocks moving. The only possible encounter I had was that one night when I was sleeping in my tent, it was the only night, I think, the only time I've slept alone in that tent. My brother was in the guest tent, and the guest tent was all the way across the campsite. So I couldn't be like, Toby, wake up, you know. So I'm like in my bed alone, and I'm a very light sleeper, and I wake up because I hear branches breaking, and I heard rocks moving. And so there's a creek next to my campsite, and the creek is all these fairly large rocks. So you'd have to be, you know, at least 100 pounds to get the rocks to move while you're, you know, if you were to walk on them. It wouldn't be a raccoon. And so branches were breaking, it was getting closer and closer, and I heard rocks moving, and I'm lying there thinking, okay, well, if it's Bigfoot, I don't want to stir away. Wait, do I believe in Bigfoot? Wait, if I believe in Bigfoot, I should lay still. If I don't believe in Bigfoot, that could be a serial killer or a bear, and they could both maul me or kill me. Oh my God, what do I do? Wait, okay, so I look over, my dog is totally asleep. And she's so useless at this point. She's like 10 years old, practically deaf, you know. So I'm just like, please. She's like, you know, gives me the one eye. And I thought, if it is a bear or anything else, she's going to dive through the tent when it gets close and ruin my tent. That was all I was worried about. So I grab her dog collar, and I'm like, I got to put the collar on so I can restrain her, right? The dog that will get up for, like, rocks moving 5 feet from my tent. And I put the collar on, it's got, like, a click, which sounded kind of like a gun cocking. I didn't realize this. So as soon as the click happened, the animal ran off, or the serial killer ran off. So that was the closest that I came to having an encounter with an unknown creature. And then besides that, I've had kind of some miraculous things, like witnessing the life cycle of beetles. You know, there were some ficus trees that were totally infested with these beetles. 2 weeks later, there's little baby beetles everywhere. So it's kind of nice, you know, when the forest becomes your home, you sort of start to notice things that you don't normally notice if you're just there for a weekend. And that's really what the whole point of the project was about. You know, for me, the art part is that I don't expect or even want results. It doesn't matter to me if I see Bigfoot, because what happens when you wait is the most important thing for me. So that's it. Thank you. The question is, does Bobbaloo have a corncob pipe in her mouth?
She looked like she was had a corncob.
Probably. There wasn't one at the campsite, but things appear sometimes, you know? She does bring a little stash with her. Yes?
Hi. I'm wondering how far your campsite is from the Bay Area?
From the Bay Area? Almost 4 hours.
And how did you choose the space?
I chose it based on Bigfoot activity. I'm glad you asked that because I forgot to say that last November there was a sighting of 3 Bigfoot about maybe 4 miles from my campsite. And I've been to that area quite a few times to see if I can catch a glimpse of anything. I found some huge piles of crap, but I suspect there's like cows walking around there. I selected it based on historical sightings. There have been a number of actual sightings in that area, and there's also a lot of people that hear Bigfoot screams. Yes.
Is it on BLM land or private land?
It's on National Forest land.
Is it BLM?
Well, technically, there are different offices, which I haven't learned going through the process of getting permission to do this, but yeah.
So what versions are there of Bigfoot around the world? You said Bigfoot sightings were largely in North America. There are other sightings around the world of other kinds of creatures.
Right.
What have you found?
Well, you know, I didn't want to become a Bigfoot expert, so I stuck to North America. But, you know, like Yeti. Yeti would be Bigfoot's cousin in the Himalayas and in other areas. So, but there have been... you know, I was just reading this book by John McKinnon, who was the first person to live with orangutans. And when he was, you know, in Borneo, he found some strange tracks. And this is like a scientist, you know, and he has no interest in Bigfoot or other types of creatures. But he found strange tracks after he'd been living there for 2 years and had a lot of experience with all the animals. And when he went back to ask the locals, "What's this weird track I saw?" They were like, "Oh, that's the hairy man, the wild hairy man who lives in the forest." So, you know, this is like, this, it crosses cultures. Yeah. Oh, and the place where the exhibit was, where the projections of this piece are, there's the Norwich shuck, the black shuck, which is a wolf that eats children. Right? Isn't it? You're kind of from the area.
Well, the hound of the basket. I love your thing about mystery.
Yeah.
Because I think the desire for mystery, we see this coming up again and again.
Yeah.
And
the fairies, the fairy
this.
Yeah. Yes.
What is the current belief on how big Bigfoot's foot is?
Big.
isn't it like 14 to 18 inches, David?
It's print? Big.
It's big.
Big.
14 to 18 inches is the average, sort of, the scope that we're working with. I can't remember the width. I'm
big.
Sorry.
Is it 8 feet tall?
Yeah, about 8 feet tall. Yeah. Anyone else? Has anyone? Oh,
no.
I was just gonna say, has anyone ever had a Bigfoot encounter that you're willing to share with us? Has anyone had an inflatable encounter? No. I'll look for furries next.
What we did have is, I was a little bit too young for this, like maybe 2 years after, so it was my big brother. And what we did have was the word got out that there was a sighting up by the lake. And so everybody got in their cars.
Where is this?
This is in Connecticut.
Okay.
Upstate New York.
They're all over.
Yeah, and so everybody got it in their cars. It was the event at the town. Everybody was calling everybody and calling everybody, and they all rushed up there, and they were looking. The state police came and kicked everybody out.
That's how it usually ends. And the reports.
Speaking of getting kicked out, tell them about the viewing the camera on the campsite versus not on the campsite.
What I was allowed to do?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm totally breaking the rules. Whatever. But, no, I mean, the National Forest was going to charge me for a commercial permit, $50 a day, to aim my cameras at humans, because that's considered theater, which I thought was totally fascinating. So I was like, okay, I won't do that. But we did it. That's crazy. I'm losing money. I borrowed from Bank of Palos. I mean, I am so indebted right now. So. Anyone else?
This was directing cameras at consenting humans who said that
exactly.
They weren't...
Exactly. I couldn't put a camera... I couldn't train a camera on my own website.
It seems like I've heard rumors that you started a trend in the Bigfoot community.
Oh.
If you go to findingbigfoot.com, you'll see this horrible, horrible man named Tom Biscardi, who is hated, just completely despised by the entire Bigfoot community because he's a total capitalist pig who is a producer in Las Vegas. So you can imagine where I'm going with this, right? He decides a month after my campsite started to do the same thing I'm doing, but to pay for slightly better bandwidth. So he's broadcasting like live in the forest these moving cameras to, I don't know if they're live, but maybe they're daily, you know, feeds of him looking for Bigfoot up in the Del Norte area. I mean, this project's about to end. I'm in the El Dorado area where like the real Bigfoot hunters go. No, but he's up in Del Norte, the other area. And he has promised within 2 weeks to find Bigfoot, to capture one. And people have to pay $59.95 to see the live feed.
What you should do is actually, that guy in Texas could have the cameras with the guns on them so you can hunt from your house. You get those, you know, for an extra $100 you can hunt Bigfoot.
Well, maybe I should hunt Tom Biscardi. Oops, I thought you were a jackass.
With the hunting season.
There are people that, you know, there are two camps. There's the, if you see Bigfoot, shoot it. If you see Bigfoot, observe it. Yes?
How can
you meet Bigfoot? Oh, fabulous idea.
Bigfoot.
I'll have to consider that. I'll have to bring back a cupcake. It's been a while. Cupcake in college. Cupcake goes to Oregon State. We're Bigfoot. Yeah. All right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I guess our next speakers are Scott Miniman and Dale McDonald.
I'd love to do this without a microphone so people can stay away from some of the noisy interactives. That would make me really happy. There'll be plenty of time to do that afterwards. In fact, we're going to keep this talk fairly short, just trying to... because I think the talk is actually the booby prize in our particular case. The fun part is walking around the space here and seeing some of the interactives we've got running. And, yeah, so hopefully everybody can make some time. There's some of them are a little bit subtle, so kind of walk around the whole space. There's probably about 8 or 10 of our interactives working in some form or another out there. So... I'm Scott Miniman, this is Dale McDonald. We're going to be talking about Make Tanks, a new paradigm for innovation, or how dorks still run the universe. So Make Tank is a term that was coined by Tim O'Reilly, from what we can tell, when he was talking to Danny Hillis about Applied Minds. And thinking that the Applied Minds might be called a make tank, a sort of riff on the think tank notion. And a make tank being a lab that figures out how to design and build hardware that solves interesting new problems. And we like to at least delude ourselves into thinking that we're one of those. So Anomie, the company that occupies the space that you're in right now, we were founded in 2002 by former members of the group RED from Xerox PARC. So several other former members are also in the audience. It's good to see a bunch of people. And we're an S corporation. We're all completely self-funded. We're obviously in Menlo Park, although I heard a few of you had some adventures getting here. That's where you ended up if you're in the building. There's about 2,500 square feet here right at the moment, 2,000 up here, another 500 of the shop, which will be open afterwards. And then we're actually taking over another 2,000 square feet of the building for a project, especially for a project that I'll show in Open Dork really briefly. And yeah, we're a make tank. We concentrate on interactives. For trade show applications, hands-on science museums, places like that. Anomie is, we're often asked about this, so I'm just going to cover it. It's a Greek suffix meaning study of. It's got a slightly shaded meaning that it's uncovering hidden truths. as opposed to experimentation, which is more the shading of ology, shows up obviously in taxonomy, astronomy, economy. But mainly, Anomy was a sensible 500. It was available when they needed it. I've been going through all these Greek roots and trying to find a reasonable name. That's where we end up. So, Anomy is about creating signature interactives. We've been working in trying to kind of come up with new media types. In our incarnation at PARC, we were actually claiming that we were coming up with new genres. There's still a debate within people in the company about whether or not you can actually come up with a social convention, which is essentially what a genre is, and so I'll just leave it at that. But the things we actually build, we kind of think of as narrative machines, storytelling devices that come in various forms, and in particular, storytelling devices where there's a deep resonance between the form of the object and the story that's being told on it. So there's examples of that out in the space. Today, Harry the Ape is one where there's a pretty deep resonance. The reading eye dog has kind of odd resonance. The interactive walls have long been being used as timeline browsers, and once again, there are very, very nice resonance between the form of the technology and the technology itself. I guess a really extreme form of that would be something like, you know, Tamaguchis, where, you know, they actually built a very specialized device to tell that very simple narrative, but it was a kind of one-off physical form. We try to employ cutting-edge technologies and configurations of those technologies. Our clients, as I said before, started to go into our hands-on science museums. We have pieces at the Tech. We have several pieces at science museums around Mexico. We have two or three pieces in Singapore Science Center. Just quite a few hands-on museum placements. We also do corporate trade show and briefing centers. The Philco Predicta that's in the kind of garden room area, that was done for Sun Labs. They actually came back to us for four more of those after we built the first one. Do take a look at that, it's kind of fun. And then we also do work for research labs, actually Sun Labs being one of them. We try to work at this kind of science, engineering, art, and design. This is an old graphic actually done by Rich Gold, who was our manager at PARC. It's depicting the kind of the pair of intersections that we try to operate on between what he liked to call the kind of four creative disciplines. There's probably more than that in the real world, but these are four that are easy to call out and have identifiable methods, and various members of the company kind of have their feet in two or even more of those quadrants. So we actually consciously try to apply the methods and conventions of those various creative disciplines. And we use a genre-based design approach where we try to come to grips with what it is, the setting, all the particulars of the location where one of our pieces is going to be placed, as well as the listening or the set of eyes that the visitors are going to bring to that setting and to our piece. That'll come up a little bit later as well. So we're posing make tanks kind of as an alternative to the traditional think tank. I'm sure there are lots of history of technology theses about this, and I'm going to do a complete bastardization of any of that work. And in particular, I'm talking about think tanks here, where people actually are kind of building things and kind of working on machines, as opposed to some pure political think tanks. But I would assert that they arose with the industrial complex. If you look at all the existing and historical major players, everyone had one. They involved, I think they rose largely out of a concentration of expertise. The manufacturing and production was being centralized, and so it all of a sudden made sense that you could afford to hire someone who was doing research around a product or service, hopefully gain some competitive advantage that gave you an advantage as well in the marketplace. They morphed a little bit at some point into innovation for innovation's sake. A lot of times the research at some of the think tanks was fairly undirected, depends on where you look where in time you look. But at some points from the time at Park, I can say that there were times when all you had to have was a pretty weak story of how your research could, in some imaginable future, be applied to some business that could or maybe be part of Xerox's business. And then at other times, it was quite directed. And as we've seen in recent years, a lot of peer research centers have been either closed down or had huge budget cuts as all these companies kind of tighten their belts and try to be kind of globally competitive. They, at some level, they were corporate jewels, and I kind of mean that in a couple senses. One is that they were showpieces for a corporation and could actually draw attention to the corporation. The other is that they would create jewels, which then the companies traded amongst themselves as a way of kind of keeping other companies from suing them about patent infringement and intellectual property infringement. So basically a lot of these companies amassed patent portfolios that they could then kind of choose and barter with competitors to keep themselves from basically suing each other at this. So I thought I'd try and anchor us in historical terms. I think Da Vinci definitely was one of the early Meg tanks. It's unclear from the pieces that have actually, people who've taken the sketchbooks and then gone ahead and built some of his pieces, it's unclear how many of the pieces he actually built, because a lot of them don't do what they're supposed to do. But nonetheless, there were some pieces, this is a thing that was in one of his sketchbooks. Shows a bicycle actually with a chain. This was kind of reinvented then again in 1850. So 350 years before the invention, the kind of acknowledged invention of the pedal bicycle, Da Vinci had one at least on the drawing boards. The Wright brothers are another, I'm kind of calling out the war horses of historical make tanks. And I think make tanks, both in their long history and in their more recent history, have a much more grassroots element to them as well. But the Wright brothers were clearly operating, building things that they didn't really understand all the theory of. This is a reconstruction of Edison's Menlo Park facility. This is actually at Greenfield Village, I think, in Michigan. I think the other thing that some of the make tanks, some of the early make tanks, probably invented was a Superfund site. You look at these places, and they're just they're just scary collections of stuff. But, and they were often like in the middle of some residential neighborhood.
Curie's laboratory pair of
nice. This is Chester Carlson. Chester spent a long time in Queens, New York, perfecting xerography, and in his apartment. And then, once again, all sorts of war stories about fires and weird shit that he was working with. But I think one thing that that you see in a lot of these early make tanks is that it's kind of this triad of people with access to particular tools in particular places that kind of largely influence their work. Some more recent make tanks, obviously the Hewlett-Packard Garage from the early days of HP. Jobs and Wozniak as well had their garage a little kicked around. It looks so old. Betty Nesmith Graham. This is an interesting story. She invented whiteout, which she called mistake away or something. Couldn't get anybody to pick up on it. It was in 1951. When she perfected it, she was finally making a profit by 1967. During that whole time, she continued to make whiteout in her garage and box it up and ship it. This is a picture of her, and eventually she sold the company for a great deal of money. So now, this is quiz time. Who is the book? You win the prize. Here, anonymy, winking pen. Did you actually know that? We have more. Yes, that was Michael Nesmith. That was the monkey. And you knew that his mother was the inventor of white powder. Is that how?
Oh yeah.
Everybody does, right?
Did you know
that?
Wasn't it on the
trivia
question?
All right. Okay.
All right. Carry on. Carry on. Paul McCready. Maker of the Gossamer Albatross. This is a blatant attempt to try and link ourselves with the last talk. This is a guy up in Canada who's been working on a bear-proof suit forever. This is, I think, Ursa 9. Ursa 9. It's 147 pounds of something that he's supposed to be able to wear and encounter a grizzly that lives through it. But once again, just trying to assert that make tanks are all over. There's people doing weird shit in their garages all over the place. Brad Farron and Danny Hillis have applied minds. That's where the term was actually coined. I think there's other firms that have qualities of make tank, Squid, Moto, IDEO at times. Sorry, don't mean to offend anybody, but there's a lot of not making, I mean, there's a lot of just design work that goes on at IDEO, and I think one of the things that qualifies a make tank is the fact that you're actually kind of making and designing kind of in very tight loop and prototyping. And there's a number of academic programs. Neil Gershenfeld, obviously, with the Fab Lab at MIT. Tom Igo at NYU. I know of a program that's trying to get started up at USC. I think there's also make tanks that come from other disciplines or are involved where the actual discipline that they're feeding on is different than kind of the engineering one that we do. Obviously, McSweeney's, I think, is doing that very well in the publishing area, and I'm sure there's other many, many other disciplines that would qualify as a make tank. And the rest are a few enablers. You'll see. I have a pile of handouts or hand arounds. You'll see a lot of our stuff is made of this kind of erector set for adults called 80-20. It's a great way of kind of getting things fabricated and kind of roughed up or roughed in really quickly. It doesn't really take any special metalworking tools to work with it, a chop saw. And you'll see it in a bunch of our exhibits, and anybody who wants to see some of the stuff back in the shop, it's free too, and all sorts of hardware for it. Laser cutting is a thing that we use a lot in our shop. I've got a couple pieces here. I kind of got addicted to laser cutting because we had one at Park. And it basically lets you cut a wide variety of material in kind of pretty arbitrary shapes really quickly. It's a little bit less convenient when you actually have to go to a shop outside. But turnaround is kind of 24-48 hours without any problem. Just send them a drawing. I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with these technologies, but here's a laser cutter doing plastic. If you bump up the wattage enough, you can do metal. And bumping up size, well, actually, in the open door, I'll talk about some experiments we're going to be doing very soon in a large area of laser cutting. We did a lot of work recently with water jet.
Scott, maybe you could ask him to keep it down.
Hey, shut up over there.
Shut up in the other room, please.
Thank you.
Do a lot of work with water jet, which is just abrasive in real high-pressure water. It's pretty much like laser cutting in what you can do, although you can't. Very few places will let you do partials, where you only go partway through the surface. You can specify edge quality. These are some of them are bad, some of them are medium. You can see here they're going through about a 2-inch thick piece of aluminum. And it's very economical. And if you kind of get your head around thinking in terms of kind of 2D template cutout parts, you can do pretty much everything. If you can't get your head around that, there's 3D printing technologies. This is SLA, where you actually create a part by solidifying a liquid bath of plastic and then lowering the part into the bath, and eventually you end up with the part once you take it back out of the bath. This is one of the earliest technologies.
That's how Alina does their bracing. Oh, yeah?
I didn't know that.
Well, they make a form that they print, and then they form the plastic onto it.
Right. That would work. And they also, that same technology can be used with powdered metals, so you can actually get sintered pieces of metal off the far side. Here's a piece done with a build-up, basically a hot glue gun that squirts glue into arbitrary patterns. And These are getting actually pretty reasonably priced. I mean, first off, you can, again, go to a service bureau without too much trouble, and you send them a CAD file, and you get a part back. But a desktop version of this that has an 8x8x12-inch volume is down to $24,000. Media costs are horrible, but pretty useful. And then the old standby CNC machining, a lot more lead time these days. But they're all basically within a couple mile radius. We have all these services. You'd be kind of surprised at how much of a light industrial neighborhood this is. We've got most of those vendors pretty well trained about what kind of turnaround times we want. And once you get the file formats and that kind of thing underway,
so for the kind of things we do, we're melding these forms made by all these cool technologies with humans. And one step along that line is doing sensors and actuators, and we have to play with embedded electronics to do that. And there's just a plethora of available tools to do that, and lots of people around to call who can do all of this very quickly.
Would it be possible for you to be on the microphone?
I could.
Thank you.
And then somehow this all has to run. We make quite a bit of use of open source stuff, and particularly Java work, although then again, a lot of our stuff also ends up with Packer. And then there are just a lot of other resources around, some physically, interns and that sort of thing, and others like Craigslist to just find experts for interesting stuff to use. And more there's interesting publications to sort of precipitate a make tape around. So I'm going to go through quickly an example of something we've done, which is, there's an instance up here, but we got approached by the Maryland Science Center to do something in their Terralink gallery that could be evergreen, and they wanted to base it around satellite imagery. And they somehow bumped into the world of tilty tables and thought that was a good idea. And we agreed. We long thought that map-like things were good for tilty tables. But satellite images are huge, and we weren't sure how to do the magnification or even how to select among images. We'd always done it very much single piece of content for tilty tables. But there was also the case that they came to us after they had designed their entire gallery and suddenly went, oops, this is all kind of boring. We need something to make this place pop. This happens to us a lot. So the early tilty tables were those. Like I said, we're a single piece of content per table. But proven in museum worlds that kids could sit on them and play on them and try to destroy them and not succeed. They're fun for really all ages. So, after some brainstorming around, and also because we'd had a tilted table laying around in our lab, we played with it and thought of things we might want to do. And one notion that had come up, actually in the context of turn-taking with it, was the notion of a nudge sensor or a torque sensor. You know, this could work for zooming around. And so we set off playing around, prototyping, trying to figure out exactly how to not only
tilted tabletop back and forth, but to enable a limited amount of twisting to it to get zooming in and out. So, like I said, satellite images are bloody huge. And so we did a bunch of poking around and came across something called JADE, the Java Advanced Display Environment, which people at Caltech had done, which did some very nice things of allowing you to deal with these large images and deal with zooming. Zooming is really the hard trick. But they did some nice stuff with letting you build image pyramids and amazing lighting. And that has resulted in what you can see out here. But it's still 2D, and which means we don't get any of the advantage of this amazing computer called a graphics card. So we're now moving into a world that will take these images, turn them into triangles for us, and let us use the extra hardware we get for $59. That's
So the other part of the twisty story was, how do you insert the torque axis? So we started looking at torque sensors. You kind of figure, oh, you just go out and buy one of these. But when you think of the setting of a museum, you want the thing to be really sensitive to the slightest nudge so that people can discover that the table actually twists. So that's kind of in the half a foot pound zone. And if you've got a bunch of kids and you've got this 30-inch lever arm when you get out to the corner of a table, and you know a couple kids are yanking on the table simultaneously, you're kind of looking at 1,000 foot pounds. So if you look at the specifications for strain gauge torque cells, first off, you have all they have is 150% safety margin between the highest load that you can put on them and when they the sensors, which are actually little strain gauges, delaminate and fall off the piece of metal and they don't work anymore. The drift and the noise floor are down at 1%. So if this 150% safety margin says that you need to buy, say, a 700-pound sensor, then 1% of that is 7, and that's quite a bit higher than what you were aiming for to have the sensitivity. When we talked to the manufacturers about these things, they said, okay, look, just put in mechanical protection. But then so basically you give it end stops. But those end stops are actually very close to, they basically end up having kind of clunky table movement, and didn't like that idea. So I searched a little bit more. It turns out there's this torque cell that you can buy that uses surface acoustic waves. So I guess a piece of metal under tension has a different speed of sound propagation along its surface than a piece that's not under tension. So if you look at the two 45-degree axes of a piece of metal that's being torqued, you can see how much torque is being exerted on that shaft. Has fantastic resolution, has a really high overload margin, but you don't even need the overload margin once you have that kind of resolution. And they're about $7,000, which is actually a really significant portion of the cost of a tilty. And partially because it's completely over-specified in terms of bending torques and all sorts of other things that we actually don't, loading directions that we don't put the torque cell into. And even harder was convincing them that we don't put the torque cell into those loading zones, because they look, the manufacturers of these things look at our table and they say, oh, there's going to be a huge bending load on the torque sensor and it's going to fail. And I had the longest conversation and stacked back and forth three body diagrams and eventually got them to where they wouldn't guarantee that it wouldn't fail, but they were starting to believe me enough that they would sell me one of their sensors. But alongside this, because I've been panicked about the fact that we couldn't just buy a load cell, and these guys were being a little bit obstructive, and the price was really high, we were on the side kind of rolling our own. And what we've done is compliant rubber pucks between a pair of metal plates, and you just measure the displacement between the two plates. It turns out you have to have multiple displacement sensors in order to filter out straight displacements, which happen when people just push on the side of the table. But once you do that, it's actually a really good torque sensor. It has all the range requirements we need. It's not stiff in the sense that these other torque sensors would be, but we actually don't need stiffness. There's a slight hysteresis issue, hysteresis being the tendency for the thing not to come back to a home position. But actually, we've fixed most of that with choosing the right rubber for the rubber pumps. So this is what it looks like for the table that's in Maryland. The one on our table here is a little more exposed, so you can actually take a closer look at it. I embedded it in the surface because it turns out one of the things that you're constantly trying to do with a tilty table is keep the center of rotation very near the surface so that the table, when it moves, doesn't move out from underneath the projector, because that means you have to throw away pixels. So this one's better than the problem. This is a delivery table. That's actually the table that's kind of Maryland. That's the kind of old mechanics that you can see on the table out there. This is the final product installed in Maryland. This is actually a printed graphic. I wish they had a really high resolution projector like that. And it's delighting people right left. So yeah, it works great. It's happy customers. Some growing pains. We seem to always have some rude surprise or the other. Never fatal. But things like we specified a new projector for this because we wanted to run higher resolution. And it turns out that the projector really doesn't like being in the nose down orientation. Of course, if you ask people about this, they say, well, we don't know. And you ask a manufacturer and they generally don't know whether it's going to work in that particular orientation because very few of their customers put it in that orientation. But it turns out that most of that problem was the filters. The museum this particular museum is a pretty dusty place, and so the filters in the projector clog, the thing overheats, and then go through $750 bulbs really quickly. And it's not a very popular thing in the museum. In fact, the projectors shut down before they go through a bulb, so basically what was happening was that the thing would run for a few hours, it would thermally shut down, they'd come back in, they'd power back up, and it would work for a few more hours. Sure, what really needs to be done in this particular case is some like really huge pre-filter box, that's kind of like an air box. And one of the things, as we get better with maps and smoother and faster with maps, we're starting to see some new markets. We took this to, we were invited, so some people in Maryland saw the table at the Maryland Science Center They are now in the queue to buy two. One's going in the mayor's office, and the other is going in the planning department for Baltimore for them to use for helping people, site new retail developments, things like that. These are, I don't even know who all these mayors are. He's like the mayor of Baltimore and New York and Washington, D.C. Yes, I got sidetracked. So we took those folks invited us to go to their booth in Las Vegas for the International Conference on Shopping Centers, which is where the people who do development for shopping centers do like 30-second dating with the people who have towns that need shopping centers. And so basically a lot of big towns show up there and they kind of show their, trying to basically attract, a Walmart or a new shopping mall. And so that our table was in the Baltimore booth being an attractor for Baltimore, the city, for retailers. And it worked really well at that. The mayor loved it. He got in. And that's why he's being one of the bosses. Because he can't. So just wrapping up, we've been trying to kind of think about, this is very much a kind of talk in progress. We're trying to get our heads around what it is that that contributes to make tanks and make tanks being successful versus unsuccessful. And so what are they as a place and what are they in places and their locations? How important is that? Obviously, ours is very open studio. There's a lot of hands-on resources. We do a lot of prototyping, in the minute. When a question comes up, we just kind of build and figure out what works, what doesn't. There's a lot of nearby resources. Like I said, all those fabrication technologies, there's a job shop for all those within a couple miles of here.
What do you mean by open?
The fact that we really don't have that. We don't have cubicles. We don't have offices. The whole space is open. People know when I'm using the chop saw. That's a negative example. People know when I'm spraying in the back without a spray booth.
How many people do you have that are participants in this community?
In the company?
Yeah, our Anami people.
Anami is 7 people right now, and that's the full-timers. We have a huge, we kind of have a huge Rolodex, and we're bringing in resources all the time for particular projects. In particular, we don't have like an in-house graphic designer. We farm all that out and basically match people to the look and feel that we're after on a particular project. So there's the nearby resources. There's also kind of the one-click resources that are becoming more and more prevalent. I've never set foot in my water jet person's office. Everything has been, I send them a file, and either the parts are picked up by somebody else, or he mails them to us. There's that in terms of the services, and then there's obviously that in terms of buying things off the web these days. We do a lot of McMaster Car orders. As long as you get a McMaster Car order placed by 6 p.m., it shows up at your doorstep the next day at 2 o'clock by somebody who won't come through our door for some reason. There's this guy, and he just like timidly knocks on the door, and he won't come in. If we kind of know that there's a McMaster Car order coming, because sometimes you can't. So, at least this particular make tank is it's kind of demo or die. We're constantly doing demos, constantly kind of showing people something that's close enough to the thing that we're proposing to do for them that they can kind of get their heads around what it is that we're trying to do for them. we learn a lot from the demos, from listening to our customers, listening to potential customers, and then there's this whole kind of way of working, kind of musing about something we might want to be doing, reading it out, sometimes doing a sketch, sometimes building, try it out, cycle until there's no more hours in the day, and come back and do it tomorrow. That said, I really encourage you to kind of walk around, see the demos, ask questions of any of the Onimus. There's two here, there's more outside. and we'll open the shop as it is right at the moment. And, yeah.
How do you find customers? Do they find you, or do you find them? Or?
Yes. it's interesting. to a certain extent, we have a lot of museum connections in the wake of having done Experiments in the Future of Reading, which was a show that we did in kind of the last 2 years that we were at Xerox PARC. So we had a lot of museum connections, many of which had kind of dried up because if those customers or potential customers came to us while we were at PARC, we basically kind of said, well, you know, you're offering us money, we don't do money, at least at that point, PARC didn't do money. And so it was really hard to figure out how to make those partnerships work. But a lot of those people remembered us and came back once we were our own company. There's a lot of word of mouth in this community, in the museum community at least. There's a lot of people moving from place to place. The trade show area, it's mainly making contacts into other trade show firms. We're not somebody that a company is going to come to if they want a, you know, a 60-foot by 80-foot booth, you know, built end-to-end. That's not what we do. But once we make the connection with the company that does that, they know to call us for the sizzle that's in their booth. So it's a mix. We're starting to go out into more markets and, you know, things like the urban planning area where we've actually kind of been actively seeking that out. Yeah, we had an invite for Ted to show one of our walls there. So occasionally we'll get that kind of connection as well, where we get some pretty high profile exposure for the very low cost of them renting one of our pieces. That works out really nicely in a lot of cases.
Do you know about corporate philosophy or commitment to maintaining that? Say, for example, the tilty table became, you know, wildly in demand. So people were asked, is your answer with that to sell the IP or let it spin off a manufacturing group?
We would spin off a manufacturing group or get it done somewhere else. I think the commitment is to doing the first one of it. and, you know, we're mostly committed to somehow making a living at making cool stuff and iterating on that until... so that's basically our... If something gets popular, or even when things... When you get in the third instance of something, you know, I suspect it's like, you know, what a rock star or somebody feels like when they're, you know, having to perform this stupid song that they did 7 years ago for somebody they don't even know. You know, I mean, it's got to be like that. We get procedures in place and parts lists and make it so that, you know, all you do is send out a whole bunch of orders and a bunch of parts come back and eventually we'll even get to the stage where it doesn't need my hand.
What's the ratio of
like
engineering building
There's it'd be hard to say what that ratio is. A lot of the design is done iteratively. We prototype things into existence and kind of stop when it's good enough and robust enough. So there's some upfront design work, and you know, a lot of our pieces benefit from that, but we try not to go overboard on that. So it's really hard to say. A lot of time in my dad's work at the moment. When we get real busy, I'd say it's probably at least 60-40 at desk to shop, even when we're really busy. A lot of that's just ordering parts and kind of getting all the ducks in a row. And I end up art directing a lot of the pieces, so it's a lot of fun calling.
Is there a downside, would you say, that prototyping was a thing like opposed to sort of pulling out of design and having felt sometimes like start building it too soon?
I think we get to the point where we know how to juggle all the possibilities and you know, I suspect. Yeah, I actually don't think that there's much of a drawback, as long as you're smart about being, about your making, and kind of, you're always hedging bets, you're always covering for other possibilities, you're always kind of continuing to search for that elusive part that you're pretty sure isn't available, so you're starting to make it yourself. Yeah, it's this constant dance of managing, just juggling a whole lot of possible paths and making sure that there's always one that's sure to work, and then there's all these, you know, possibly easier, possibly different.
I would ask you about collaborations. I mean, one thing, some people you talked about were, it seemed like they were solo artists.
When we get really deeply in whatever discipline is one or the other on their specialties, it gets pretty, I don't write any code, or I write very little code. I do some of the embedded stuff, but, Dale doesn't run the mill. And we have other people, you know, there are others of us who help out in some of those cases, but I think the overall endeavor here is very collaborative. We're constantly, we know where the edges are. We're kind of constantly making sure that everybody knows what's changing at the edge that you care about, or what's changing at the edge that Dale cares about, and what are we doing that's influencing the look and feel of this piece, so I got to tell the artist. And that's the benefit of, you know, a group of people who've worked together for a really long time. They know what level of detail to talk about in those overlap areas, and they know exactly when to bring them up.
Can you talk a little bit about the muse aspect of it? One of your slides, you said something about muse. Do you guys draw them, or do you...
There's a lot of sketching.
I see a lot of whiteboards.
There's lots of whiteboards around here. We're constantly doing that, and thinking through how things might work. And we use a variety of computer applications as well that help that. Some programs like SketchUp, which is a really, really lightweight kind of CAD program. It just lets you do 3D things really amazingly quickly. We're constantly reflecting. I mean, I think reflection is just a huge part of what we're doing. You take a stab at something, think through whether or not, you know, what worked, what didn't work, report that back to the people who need to know about it. We should probably, I don't know what you're going
to do. Continue to open here. Yeah, we can.
But we probably want to try.
Probably should do open doors, that way people can mingle. So let me call them.
People in the outside room.
Excuse me.
It's open dark time. So, anybody who...
Okay, very quick, less than 5 minutes. It's a bot, and by God, is it dorky. So, so I invented it. I had some folks helping me out. Tim Black, many of you may know him from Burning Man. He did the lights that go around the man. I'm sorry I didn't know about Onomy. I would have subcontracted it out to you guys with the hindsight, because the thing about Tim Black is don't talk to him anytime around Burning Man, as he gets it. He gets distracted, and anytime around Burning Man turns out to be like October. So here's the idea. This is kind of influenced by some of the stuff that Eric Paulos did very early on with kind of robotic avatars. So you can go to a different place, and you can see the different place through a camera. But the thing about this is people can see you on a honking big LCD display, which you can move around because it's on a robotic arm, and it will kind of do positions and things like that. Okay, so this is the thing in action. So Tim, the idea was that I invented it, and Tim was going to do all the hard work. He did this nice design with parallel struts, so the axes are independent. We got DC motors with position encoders on things. The idea is you can have kind of a conversation with this. It acts as your surrogate in a meeting or teleconference. Is Eric Paulos around? Because I need to ask him where to help with politics. This is kind of an artist conception of how this works. This is obviously the future because everybody is sober. Yeah. Okay, so here's a video with Microsoft all button down. Here's the thing, you kind of drive it with a joystick. Here's the thing, actually. We're using DV over IP for the actual image, which is kind of terrifying to see me at high resolution. So we're working on a better video with some kind of hot model. This is kind of what it looks like when you see the thing directly. And the whole thing is kind of terrifying. That's about it. Anybody has any technical questions, ask me. This is what Scott would call a weak story from a research lab, but it's been a fun thing to play. So, questions now quickly, or we take things offline?
Thanks, Eric.
Eric, so props to you, because he invented one of the first ones of these that actually rolls around. I didn't want to go there because it's hard to navigate and they wobble and stuff like that.
I wondered, do you use the A20 extrusion for all the aluminum products?
No. These are just bar stock.
Roughly, what is the price of this?
I couldn't tell you. We use a lot of surplus for the motors. The actual pivot is one of those things you use on a machinist thing that's probably got a name, right? You can dial in the angle and put it on your drill press, so if you want to go 32 degrees, you dial it 32 degrees.
Rotary
index. Thank you. Put a pulley on it and zip it goes around. So I'd probably say 1,000 in parts or something, but most of the hard part was the engineering. As I said, my idea is that I've been promoted to my level of incompetence, which turns out to be PowerPoint. My idea was that Tim Black would do all the fiddly bits about doing all the things, but anyway, he kind of bailed out halfway through, so I wound up doing all the fiddly bits and getting the software to work, and getting this work over the internet's a little bit tricky because there's some latency, and the thing going like this, you want to smooth it out, so you put a little PID control in it, position control, something like that. But you can take that offline, because I'm sure that's fascinating to about three people. Any other questions?
Yes, sir. Start to finish, how long did it take you to get to this point?
Probably about 2 years, but we were not the most efficient. I had other things going on, and Tim kind of flaked, and I was hoping we'd get back on the case, but he didn't, so.
So did your bank plan to, like, sell it at the rights, or was it?
Well, I work for a place called FX Pal. We're kind of a park wannabe. We're funded by Fuji Xerox. I think we're kind of a jewel laboratory. So one of our products is cool demos for the VIPs from Japan. So right now we're at this level. I don't know where we go with it. Yeah. I'm almost embarrassed to say I did this in my day job. Hardly seems fair. Any questions? Okay, next up. Next victim.
Bruce Damer is going to say something. He's going to show off this. He made this jacket himself. An iPod jacket.
This project is to create sort of cyberware that's really cool and looks good, that isn't all like Steve Mann. You don't look like a cyborg or a military man. And the idea of this project was to create, I'm kind of a big fan of computing history. When you had S100 computers, you had an open bus where you could put your own cards in. Well, this is a garment with buses. So, for instance, I can put my cell phone or something here and have my cords going through here and coming up the back where I want to come through, you know, say for speakers or something like that, or put a cell phone booster antenna there. I can wire my iPod like this, you know, around the back. And it's based on a 16th century garment called a doublet. And doublets, one of their features, they had this thing called peplum. And I made one, I took a sewing class and I wanted to learn how to make garments, and I made a Renaissance doublet with a Renaissance book. And I looked down at this peplum and I said, what on earth is this for? Well, this is for all your gear. And then I thought back to Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash, because as Karen knows, that I've been doing the Avatar stuff for a long time. And I wanted to sort of make myself an Avatar. And there was a character named JT who had wares all over her body, and she went in and she took out the fellow gunman with this garment. I was wondering, what was JT wearing? So this is kind of like what JT is wearing in the 21st century. So it's cyber renaissance, 21st century tech or something. And if anybody is interested in whipping together garments like this, I have a studio in a Ken Kesey style 1960 International Harvester school bus that is kitted out with everything you need to make Mary Prankster's garments. So see me afterwards. If you want to look at this on the web, it's cyberwares.com, either an S or a Z.com. That's where the garment is featured, and it's step by step how to make this.
W-E-A-R?
Right, not W-A-R.
Right. How long did it take you to make it?
This was god awful. This, I think about 3 months, but maybe working a few hours a week to 10 hours a week over about 3 months. And the materials in this are kind of weird. You're not supposed to be able to sew this together. You're not supposed to be able to put spandex on top of velvet. And so what I did was I invented a way to make it all Velcro panels that are removable. So everything comes off. So if you don't like this panel, you can stick another one on. You can detach the sleeve. You can detach the peplum and just make a new one. So it's like
modular.
It's a modular. So the idea was, I was wearing this into the Apple store today, and all the green-shirted Apple genius guys come over like, it's iPodware. Where did you get this? And I said, I made it, and if you see Steve Jobs, and he likes one, I'll make one for him too. Because the idea is, if he puts me on the Apple store, but you know, you should be able to buy a base garment and then accessorize. Be able to have like jewelry pieces or panels or, you know, the garment business is way behind. They don't understand the whole idea of buy the base model and then add stuff and customize your own clothing. This is an idea about customized clothing.
Yeah.
Any more questions?
I hope the gears was the static from the Velcro.
Yeah, static. Well, this is. If you notice, you see how the holographic pattern goes? Sort of a multicolored pattern?
Yeah.
that's spandex from House of Spandex in New York City. Like, I was looking through 500 types of spandex, and there it is. It's holographic and trippy, and I can put it on the garment. Any more questions? I'm sure there's other people who. Seagraphs. I'll go next year for sure in the fashion show. Thank you very much.
Anything else want to do an open door? For announcements or Scott?
Just one thing. One little bit that didn't fit in our previous talk. One thing that didn't fit in our previous talk, it's kind of a work, it's definitely a work in progress. In fact, just won the competition for this piece about a month and a half ago. It's at the Liberty Science Center in Jersey City, New Jersey, and they have a 40 by 40 foot, like 40 foot atrium that they wanted a kind of showpiece for. If any of you have been there, that's where the biggest Overman sphere in the world had been up until the remodel that's starting in Wisconsin. So there's an 18-foot Overman sphere that articulates a very beautiful piece. They're remodeling that space and adding 100,000 square feet of museum space, and they held a competition for the pieces that would be now occupied the lobby, the inspiration for which was Times Square. They wanted to kind of Times Square of current science content. Had to run unattended, so there's no person feeding it content every day, so we've got to kind of solve that problem, and then also the just how it looks. So we kind of went out on a limb and told them that they didn't really want Times Square because Times Square was 20 miles away from them, and how could they better Times Square? That we were going to do something kind of different than what so here's some quick architectural models done in Maya. This is the 40 by 40 foot cube. These pieces in here are huge mobile that we're building to put in the space. It's, each of these pieces are about 15 feet on the side. There's internal video projections onto the faces of the
internal.
Yeah, the projectors will be inside, wirelessly connected. The power is going to be coming down the cables, that twin cable system for a reason that we'll see in a minute. This one, the museum kind of has the theme, so this is environment, this is a gear, it's supposed to be invention. This is a piece of cancellous bone, the foamy bone that you get in your hip. Any place where the body is trying to make bone mass lighter than it would be if it was stronger. And that one looks a little bit too much like a piece of HVAC equipment right in front of it, but we're going to fix that. This is from the upper floor, so you can actually approach this piece from any one of a number of floors. There's some moving zipper signs on the concrete spandrels. There's some spray of video here, but the main thing is these, this large mobile that's in the middle. We call it the science mobilized. This is looks like this is what happens if you kind of come in and look up at the piece. So you know, these are all these surfaces are video projections. And they're going to be optimized to be a little bit bigger. And then there's some vertical zipper signs that serve as the counterweights for the shapes. Because what you can't see in the in those flybys is that these shapes are actually also on a winch system. So they're changing so that they're available to the different floors at different times. This is about an hour's worth of movement put into a 30-second clip. So these pieces are moving around the space. So as well as moving side to side like a mobile does, they're also basically a simple elevator system. And then the piece is interactive. The visitors with their cell phones can call in and kind of contribute suggestions to what's on the shapes at any particular time. There's a lot of interactivity of various forms. When there's images that don't have textual explanations, you can call up a number that's actually in the corner of the screen here on your cell phone and hear what an explanation of what that piece is. That's actually tying into a system that's going into the whole museum called Science Now, Science Everywhere. And then I guess the thing that most relates this to, well, there's lots of reasons why this relates to Open Dark. There's a bunch of really interesting technology that's going to be scrolling for RSS feeds, gathering all the information that goes on here daily, deciding how to automatically author it for the particular shape that it's going on or the particular media that it's going on, if it's a textual spray or a vertical text display. But the other part of it is the way we're going to be doing the shapes themselves is using laminate design. I don't know how many of you were the open or the door cloud a while back about the lamina, but it's a fabrication method that takes an arbitrary nerve solid and turns it into flat pieces of material that arsenic approximate it, and then you get those laser cuts and weld them up, and this is a stainless steel piece that weighs 14 pounds, about 6 feet long, really, really thin stainless, made with this laminate program. Wonderful thing that we're planning to use to make big shapes in the space. And one of the things that means is that we have to be able to laser cut very large pieces of plastic. And laser cutters get pretty expensive when they get anything big. Well, they're expensive to begin with. And then they get more expensive when you want one that's big. Something with kind of a 3-foot by 2-foot bed is still something on the order of $40,000. We're going to build one kind of from a laser cutter kit. We're currently planning on building a 5-by-10-foot laser cutter. About the only thing that happens when you try to make the laser cutter really big is that the beam diverges. You basically have to do some compensation for how far it is you're away from the laser source. You don't move the laser around, you move a bunch of gears around. But depending on how far away you are from the source, you've got to use the laser power to change the speed. And we're going to do that to build a really big laser cutter and put it in the back of this building. Thereby kind of being the next generation of the super fun site version of MegPack. Anyway, stay tuned on this one. I'm sure we'll be giving another presentation about it as we get the software and some of the other stuff more in place. But, second project, we're thrilled to have gotten our permission. And then, is there one more?
I don't see them, so. The snooze they lost. Well, thanks everyone for coming.